This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with Russ Besley, Mike Dines, Gords, and Paul Aguera, who are the editors of The Punk Reader and a number of books on punk, number of volumes on punk, which we can talk a little bit more about today. So thanks for being here with me.
Hi, good to see you.
Oh, yeah. So, you have a number of volumes, edited volumes on punk and punk scholarship. So we could maybe start by talking a little bit about how these volumes came to be, what you were trying to do, and how you started putting together these punk readers and texts on punk.
It started in my front room, Mike, didn't it?
Yeah. We've got to remember that we are kind of the series editors of global punk. With Intellect, and underneath that umbrella, we have a number of punk readers. So we have three punk readers, two that are already out, and one that is on the verge of coming out in the middle of December. And beyond that, we have another four books, which includes Punk Lo Americas, Punk Pedagogies. There's a really good book by Simon Strange on punk and art, and also one by Marie Skov, which is again on art school and punk. So the four of us are kind of global series editors. Underneath that, we're also punk. We're also editors of the Punk Reader. And like Gould said, it kind of started off, the Punk Scholars Network kind of started off in his front room when we got together to have a chat. And from the Punk Scholars Network, there came this idea about being a Punk Scholars Network press. And I remember the meeting, the Punk Scholars meeting that we had about the press. And the idea said, look, you know, why don't we have this imprint? And from there, Russ said, look, why don't I take this idea over to Intellect? Because Russ is editor of Punk and Post-Punk, the journal. And Russ then took the idea to Intellect. Intellect really liked it. And from there, he started to negotiate this kind of contract to create what we now call as the Global Punk Series.
So I think it starts out with the two separate things. The Punk Scholars Network, that was something that Goulds and Mike came up with in 2012, I think, as originally, how do we build us a network support network for people who study punk? And that was the original idea. How do we build a peer review process, a kind of network that supports each other in this field, this emerging field? And then about five or six years later, this kind of led to this idea of a book imprint, didn't it, Mike? And it started with the Punk Reader, yeah, which we're going to talk about, and then that moved into a second and third volume of the Punk Reader. The second one's out, the third one's just coming out soon. And then it's extended from there to a global punk book series, which includes monographs and other titles that are all under the heading. So they're not necessarily about, it's global punk in a broad sense. So it's the world of punk. So it includes histories. So I think Mike came up with the idea of Punk Reader, didn't you, as to what that would be?
It was definitely Mike who came to me with it and said something around, because the majority of the literature then, and I mean, we're talking nearly 10 years ago, seemed to be concerned predominantly with a lot of historical aspects around the punk scene or stuff that was kind of dragging itself, kicking and screaming into the 90s. And we weren't seeing the sort of material around what was going off presently or reflected in our lives. I mean, that was part of Punk Scholars Network as well, to bring things into contemporary views about aging, about different genders and identities and all that kind of stuff. And about what people are doing, aging in the punk scene, etc. And what's going off, not just in the UK, America and Europe, but across the world. And me and Mike started it off with a brainstorm, bad word, thinking about where we could go with this in my office in Leicester. And that's where I remember it starting. And it took a lot of effort, shall we say, to get the first edition together in much more of a DIY way. We were both stressed out, me and Mike as original editors, but then I said, I can't cope with this. Let's get somebody else involved. And Mike went, I know the person, Paula, because we got involved with Paula with Kismith. And that was a brilliant move on Mike's part. And that's what happened, really, is that we moved it into that. And then it kind of gets kicked around for a couple of years. And it gradually, by 2018, becomes the first volume of the punk reader. And we were really, really chuffed with it because it felt like a lot of the records and stuff that were made, it felt very similar to that, that it was something that was very punk in its aesthetic and in its approach. But there were only 30 or something copies. I can't remember how many. So it was an instantly bought in with that. Michael.
I was going to say one thing that I really appreciated. So I have the Punk Reader and the Trans Global Punk Scenes. Well, there's a couple of things that you all highlighted some of them, is that there is this, often in punk, it's like, let's talk about the US and let's talk about Great Britain. And that's it. And those are the only places that punk happened, and punk only happened in the 70s, right? And which is, we all know, is not true. So I really appreciated that, thinking about what's going on right now, and also that punk can exist in countries that don't necessarily speak English, right?
It also helped as well that I mean, my background was in communication studies, and I was fortunate enough to be told by the great John Tomlinson his module Cultural Imperialism. And I mean, that book in the early 90s really rocked the media and cultural studies field, because it kind of questioned a lot of the kind of existing models around globalization, that the first world tends to dictate everything and they follow suit and march to that tune, and it ignores difference and it ignores a lot of non-English speaking countries and scenes. And really, a lot of the kind of philosophy in that first, or the philosophy behind that first chapter, is informed really by a lot of globalization theory and a lot of kind of John Tomlinson's spirit, in that sense of being able to look at things with an even view rather than privileging the UK or the America. I'm not saying they aren't important scenes, they are, but we need some kind of parity. And that was really what happened, is all of that kind of material informs and brings a much more contemporary twist to it. And with Russ's design, it really does kind of, not only in terms of the standard kind of prose of media and communication or interdisciplinary research, that academic tone, there's also a really vibrant visual quality to those books. The first two volumes, I haven't seen the third, I'm not involved with that. But that was it, really. I think there was a Stephen Duncombe wrote a book on kind of politics of scenes, but really kind of almost said that non-Western punk scenes were really just imitating the West, and that's not the case, as we see in many of these.
That's an important point. I think these three guys originally came up, put together the first Punk Reader as a kind of DIY project. What we said about the Short Run was it was originally published by a Paola in the University of Porto in Portugal. Yep. As a very short run. And then I took it to Intellect. I came in as designer. I came in as to help out as a designer on this and then help with some of the editing and structuring. Then took it to Intellect. They took it on as a publisher, and I'm the lead editor on the Punk and Post-Punk Journal, so I'm an editor and a writer and a designer. And they said, well, we can go with this and we could turn this into a series. So that was the original idea. Mm-hmm. So we put the first book together. The second book, we then did a call for papers and said, well, we want to continue this theme and sort of make it more global. Where can we reach out beyond the territories of that first book? And what I think I really appreciated with the second book was that we were moving into areas that were unexplored, and we were looking at how locality helps form the kind of the entire ethos and aesthetic of local punk. So it's not a copying of punk, not just punk style, and then it's transposing to Malaysia or Indonesia or wherever. Mm-hmm. There's a very much a homegrown local aspect to it that responds to local politics, local culture, and local history. So I really like there's a South White Afrikaans South African chapter in book two, which I think is fascinating because it's just such an untold story. What happens post-apartheid? What happens post-apartheid with the white South African punk scene? Where does it go? And what happens to those people? What's their identity after that? And that, I thought, was really fascinating, that it's bringing a very alternative vision of the historical context and local context to play in that punk scene. And then when we did the call for papers for the second book, we ended up being inundated. We had so many offers of papers that we ended up separating and saying, well, we'll do two books. We'll do a second and third book. And the third book, which Paul has already alluded to, is more thematic. So the first two books are geographic. And then the third book is much more about contemporary issues. So the third book is much more about things like the impact of feminism or anti-racism initiatives or the internet and new technologies, digital technologies, the kind of merging of global scenes through the internet. All those kind of debates come into the third book. So it's much less specifically regional. The third book is much more about contemporary issues. And that's coming out, well, it should be out in the next month and a half, hopefully.
Yeah.
Queer theory, yeah.
And there's trans punk in there, Gareth Schott.
Yeah, there's another one which we were offered by three other editors. Well, we didn't edit this one. It was three editors in North and South America. So it was Olga Rodriguez Loa, Rodrigo Cujano, and Shane Green. And that's a book called Punk Las Americas Edition, which is largely about South America, but it's got some North American content. And it's a mixture of academic texts with some historical documentation, some photography, some artwork, some poetry. That's coming out the same time as the next book. That's coming out in about 6 to 8 weeks' time, which is really looking at the Americas, North and South.
Yeah, that's a great book, isn't it, Russ? And I know that you designed that as well, and there is a great kind of mixture of academic articles. There's some great photos in there from Amina Cruz, for instance, looking at trans punk in Mexico. The punk reader. So what we've got here, we've got the Punk Reader One, which was a kind of an idea that I came up with to try to track post 2000 global punk, which, funnily enough, also included Britain and the US. So in the Punk Reader One, we've actually got one on power violence in the US.
That's one of my favourites, actually.
The second one was And the third one, as Russ has said, we put another call for papers out, and we got so many back that we were able to split these books into two. So one, again, became geographical, and the other was looking at kind of, yeah, these concepts. And then did you want to talk about pigs, Paola? We were talking about the fourth one. And it was kind of what we do in these books is that what's really important to emphasise here is that when we as academics publish books, they are usually published hardback, and they are usually published for £90 a pop or even more expensive. But because we do everything in-house, which mainly means that Russ does a lot of the designing and a lot of the hours in there, we get the books together. I know that Gauze did the
index
for the second book. I did the index for the third book. And we have different people that are leading on the books. And for the fourth one was going to be a pigs, which is it Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, which are kind of seen as derogatory kind of economies within the EU. Yeah, so the idea from now was, I was talking to Russ about this, was, well, right, we've got these ideas of a global, we've got these ideas of concepts, and then Paola said, look, what about pigs? And then I think from there on in, I know Russ and I were talking about kind of Southeast Asia kind of book to try to cover that geographical location, etc. And Las Americas has kind of covered the South American kind of punk, because that even deals with punks in Brazil from the mid-1970s onwards. So we were looking at other kind of geographical locations, really. And we have yet to sort out the pigs for papers. And that's really down to me, and I'm really sorry. Yeah.
So we started with the Punk Reader and it expanded, and it's become three books in the Punk Reader series, if you like, and then the Las Americas, which is a very similar one, but it's edited by three other editors. And then beyond that, talking to our publisher Intellect, they said, this theme, global punk, can it include monographs? Can it include historical books? So we've expanded from there. So we've got another four or five titles coming up. We've got one on punk pedagogies, which is an edited volume, which is relationships between punk and teaching at all levels. We've got one on European art in the 1970s and punk, which came from by Marie Skov, which was who's a Danish art historian, looking at punk in relation to art histories in the 70s in Europe. One by Simon Strange, who looks at art school education, particularly in the UK in the 1970s, and how that kind of inspired and a number of punk and post-punk artists or punk and post-punk musicians. There's one by Ian Trowell, which is the history of Throbbing Gristle, the underground art concept band, post-punk band. What's the other one, Mike?
I'm working with Ed Avery and Matt Grimes on pulling together a book on punk methodologies. In particular, using Western philosophy as a means and other kind of marginal kind of methodologies not yet used within popular music.
The other one that's a great crossover as well is Barry Phillips. His Barry's book is...
Have you not mentioned the Tito's book?
No, In Search of Tito's Punks. Yeah. This is a quick story. Barry was, as a teenager, was in a punk band in Gloucester. In Gloucestershire, in the West Country of England, and they made a record, which disappeared at the time. 35 years later, he discovered, someone contacted him, discovered it was a big hit in Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Yugoslavian bands covered this song and see this song as their kind of anarchy in the UK. So he did he travelled to Yugoslavia and travelled around, the former Yugoslavia, so Serbia, Croatia. And he wrote a travelogue. It's a kind of travel journal, diary, travelogue, history of Yugoslavia, history of the war in Yugoslavia. And it's running alongside the war crimes trials, because he at the time lived in The Hague in Holland. So it was kind of running alongside what was going on there. and interviewing musicians and label owners and DIY artists in the former Yugoslavia. And that's a fascinating book because it's such a crossover. It's a book that is a fascinating book for the everyday reader. It's not an academic book, but we're publishing it under the Global Punk series because I think that's something that Mike alluded to. What we've tried to do here is try to make these books open. In the spirit of the Punk Scholars Network, we don't want our books to be dusty, dry and academic and reserved within library bookshelves and costing £100 or $150 per copy. We do a lot of DIY input into this, and partly I do a lot of work on this as designer. And I said to when we negotiated the contract with the publishers, what if we don't take any royalties? What if we do? They said, well, the big cost is the production. I said, well, what if we do the production? So they pay for the printing and the distribution, but we'll take in hand all that pre-production. Yeah. And the proof checking and the peer reviewing. What if we did all that and didn't pay anyone and didn't pay ourselves? Yeah. Would that reduce the cost? So we managed to get these books published at a very cheap price in paperback, which is unusual in an academic book market. But we were trying to sort of to cross that bridge so that these books became more accessible to a wider readership in terms of cost and economics, but also in terms of their content. That they're not too dry, they're not preserved to academic texts. They're serious histories and serious studies, but we're trying to make them cross over into a more open readership.
Yeah, because like you say with Barry was in this band called D-Mob. And in 81, they brought this song out called No Room For You. And he said, you know, kind of 30 years later, he got a message from someone in kind of Yugoslavia that said, you know, your song is huge in the Balkans. And they gave him a link, and there he was, went onto YouTube, and there were these kind of Baltic musicians kind of playing his track. And he was the bass player at the time. Yeah. And as he talks about in the book, he says that, you know, I don't think he'd ever been to these countries before.
He hadn't.
And then he said from there on in, he just became fascinated with the way in which there were commonalities across the globe through punk. And so in around 2017-ish, he went for a kind of a road trip across Croatia, Slovenia and Serbia. And that's where a lot of this kind of this content comes from, this book. And the great thing about it is it is for the everyday reader. And that kind of Barry Phillips book links in really nicely. In fact, we haven't said much about the Punk Pedagogies book, which I think we should go back to as well, because Laura and Francis put quite good work into that. But Simon Strange's book called Blank Canvas, which is looking at the kind of art school aesthetic and the influences between art school and punk, is again, it's very much like Barry's book. It's a very easy kind of read. It's academic, it's intelligent, but on the other hand, it is a good read. It's a conversational read. And I think for me, as an editor also of Itchy Monkey Press, I think it's really important that these books are accessible. And as Russ has said, you know, we don't take any royalties, so we're able to, the work that we put in, they're able to come out quite cheap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I've got ramen for dinner.
But one thing I do love is, I mean, I think punk often is this focus on music, right? When we talk about the US, but I think, like, to me, it's often secondary to that, like the DIY aesthetic, which you're really presenting and talking about here, and those political and cultural connections and what being part of punk can bring you in being part of this larger scene and space and finding that. And so I think, like, your series, right, your readers really do that and look at that and look at the importance of that as a scene and not just a music scene, but as a larger, like, a scene identity space, right?
Yeah. A good example would be that Punk Pedagogies and the first chapter in there from Minerva Campion. And she's linking music and resistance. And she does her groundwork in Colombia. So she goes into Medellin in Colombia, and she visits these key spaces in kind of the hip hop scene and the punk scene, and then looks to see how students and punks and those in those spaces are using punk as a kind of resistance against the kind of struggle in what's going on in that city. And it's a really good chapter, and that's a perfect example of the way in which, yeah, the punk scholars have kind of and our global series is moving beyond that mere as punk as music.
The recent both the punk readers that I've been involved in, and also a lot of punk scholarship in the last 20 years, has been the kind of rise of ethnography, the rise of not having academics looking at a distance and assuming, but people speaking from within these cultures who've lived their lives from those views and that understanding of punk, which gives a lot more authenticity to what's being written about competing punk cultures and contemporary punk scenes. And with the advent of the internet and we've got ourselves into a whole new ball game. And I think that with this new book series, we're right on the money in terms of producing a lot of incisive multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary scholarship, which I think is sadly lacking in a lot of other disciplines. I think we're doing really good with this. Just me kind of adding that. But yeah.
And just to add, of course, with ethnography, the Marie Scov's book, which also deals with punk art and history, which Russ and I are currently taking to Intellect and to getting it hopefully through its first copy edit, does that. So Marie Scov, who looks at, again, that history, that link between art school and punk, not only does ethnography in you know, with Danish punks, kind of, you know, since the early 1980s. But she also talks to people like Genesis Peorich and John Savage and Mark Miller, those kind of artists. So you have got, in terms of the global punk series, quite a good spread of monographs that are coming up and also edited collections.
And also, as you know, you talk about the art scene and putting this together as a person who loves zines and studies zines, and that, like, I love the layout of the books, right? I love it. There very much is this feel like, I think you need the image, I think you need to see those flyers, I think you need to see the poster, right? And so I really appreciated that about both of the readers I have, right, that I have, that it's all there, right? It's not just like you're talking about this just dry academic text, but we get to see the images, we get to see some of the ephemera from the scenes, and I really appreciate that.
I think one of the things with that, when we did the first volume, me and Russ were particularly keen on this because rabid record collectors and zine collectors and producers of art, he had me going, right, Mexican punk gourds, where do we go for that? I go, right, okay. Oh, yeah, I've got a new record by the Inservibles. And we go and dig that out and scan it. And that got a real kind of, rather than a record that had a pressing of 200, and all of a sudden we've got this record going, connecting with those kind of ideas of the scene, with its visual content. Punk is not just music. It's a set of ethics, set of ideas, and a set of design protocols that are often autodidactive or produced by people who've got no design skills, but produce some really amazing stuff. And I think that's what that book, the first book especially, captured, especially with Andy Morgan's front cover, because he designs a lot of book for a lot of bands like Paranoid and Stray Bullet and Endless Grinning Skulls, all lots of bands, and Blind, his new band Blind Eye, and that really connected with people who would do this stuff daily with what we do as academics. And this has continued now into the kind of general aesthetic of the new book series, which has got this kind of uniformity yet originality to it, which is down to Russ again. Brilliant.
It has. I think the idea of, I really appreciate, Rebecca, what you're saying there about, yeah, it's nice to get acknowledgement for the design sometimes. Yeah, I'm so used to academic books that, as you say, are literally just textbooks, and then they might put a postage stamp size image in there and say, oh, see, figure 4.2. And I said, well, I want to celebrate these things. I want to be able to talk about these things visually. I want them to sit there right across the page so that you can, so they're in your face, so you can feel there's a direct correlation between what I'm reading about and what I'm looking at. And I balance those two because I'm a graphic designer and I'm a writer. So I tend to do both those things side by side rather than treat one as superior to the other, I guess. And that was what we were trying to do with the book. But at the same time, didn't want to go down a kind of a stereotypical punk route. The books are, you know, there's a sophistication to them as well as an elegance to them as well as
blackmail writing or whatever.
Yeah.
The military crass style, you know, the...
It would be too easy to do stencils and black letter and skulls and everything else. I've wanted it to be sophisticated yet ugly at the same time. That's what I'm looking for.
It becomes a cliche, doesn't it, when you have those kind of things? And I think we've tried to kind of keep pace with what is going on within competing scenes and reflect that, which I think's been done quite well. It's been done, you know, blowing our own trumpet, but really well. You know, that's because it's becoming from the inside. All of us do this and live it, and that shows.
And, of course, we have to mention as well that Russ designs all the stuff for the PSN conferences.
Yeah.
We're on our 8th PSN conference at the moment. Russ has just created the poster for that. And so there is a kind of there's a consistency all the way through that links in with both the punk readers. And what we see here is a subtlety as well, because Russ also designed Las Americas, punk Las Americas, which is very similar in style to the punk reader, but just a little bit different.
Yeah.
And so you've got that kind of that difference. What books are you going to, out of the new ones coming up, Russ, which are you, I know you're going to be looking at Barry Phillips, aren't you?
I'm going to design In Tito's Punks, and I'll design Simon Strange's Art School one. I think a Maurice Scobb's art in the 1970s. I'm not sure of the others yet, which ones I'm doing. I'm starting to get breathed upon. I'll try to find the right phrase, but at work, I'm starting to get questions at work and say, well, what are you spending all your time doing? Well, I'm designing books for free for this publisher and for this book series. So I'm spending an awful lot of time, including work time, and a lot of my own time, but including work time. This is my this is part of my research, and it kind of is. And at the same time, the great and the good at the university are saying, well, are you sure we're paying for your time to do this?
What is the public value of this?
you've got to remember that Russ is also an editor on the Punk Reader, as well as designer. So what happens is that when the Punk Reader, like, for instance, Punk Reader 3, it goes through 3 proofs before we can actually publish. Yeah, so going back to that.
Take care. Bye.
You know, Russ is an editor as well as a designer, and so it takes a hell of a lot of time to get something like the Punk Reader out in its form, because what happens, there are 3 proofs going on here, and then Russ has to change and have changes to all 3 proofs. And so he goes through the copy edit stage and the proofing stage with us as well. And I know with the Punk Reader 2, Russ, we ended up Zooming, didn't we, for hours, trying to find web links and just trying to sort out the last minute changes on the book. And of course, this is a lot of work that's happening outside our usual our work.
So I think it comes back to that thing. A lot of this is work that academic writers or writers in general don't see. It's a lot of this is the production which the publisher would normally take control of, and then the publisher then charges for that. So that's why the books end up costing so much they do, because there's usually half a dozen people involved in that chain that do that work. But then it comes back with us two of us involved in that chain doing that work, and not even getting paid for it. So I think that's the difference, is that, you know, a lot of those things we wouldn't even be aware of, that they need to trace a web link or something to get something live. And we're not even aware of it. Now we are. We're right at the edge of everything, all complete control, to paraphrase the Clash.
And then you might get like what happened with Las Americas, is that Russ designed the cover, obviously, sent the cover off, and one of the editors said, hang on, there was a name spelt wrong or something. Yeah. Wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't Russ's fault. It's just one of those things. And this is the last minute change. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'll better do that then. And then it goes off to the publisher.
I think one of the points as well that Russ picked up on, when you said, we get often that this, what we call free labour that is thrown in, or, you know, this kind of labour of love with these books, isn't recognised by our institutions. And it's like we don't often get recognised for the kind of achievements that are made. I'm speaking personally here, you know, with my institution, is that, oh, yeah, there's another book. But they don't think, oh, you did the index, or, oh, you wrote, you did this, or the design was done and you all kept it. None of that seems, and it doesn't matter how many times you scream at some of these people, that this is what's being achieved. It's not recognised because a lot of them work with major publishers who everything is done for them, so they see it as only the writing that matters. And with this, that there's a much more goes into these books than that, and a lack of recognition.
I think picking up on what Rebecca was saying before, it's like the punk isn't just music. It's it's an ethos. There's a lifestyle. There's an ethos. There's an aesthetic, and we're bringing that kind of DIY approach to the academic book market, which, for better or for worse, to a certain extent, we're selling our soul because we're going to an academic publisher who actually are really good. They're a very small publisher who have got good links, so they can get the marketing out there. So I do see it a bit like working with Rough Trade or one of the big independent labels and distributors. I think they're great from that point of view. But we come along and say, well, we're still retaining control of this, which is a very punk thing to do. I've been doing that kind of thing since I was 15 years old, and saying, well, I want to make my own record. I want to design my own records. Yeah. I want to do it myself. And I can't do everything myself, but I want people I can trust that I can work with to do the manufacturing or whatever it might be, or the distribution, but I'm going to retain as much control as I can, because that idea of autonomy is central to me to punk, and it has been for me for the last 40-odd years, because that's kind of what I grew up with, and of course, it's part of my life.
It's great working with someone like Simon Strange, isn't it? And also Barry Phillips, because they approached us and said, look, you know, we'd like to get these books together. And I've kind of been working more with Simon, and Russ has been working more with Barry. And between the Russ and myself, you know, we've taken these books through. We've got them peer reviewed. We've read them. We've worked with both authors in pulling these books together. So there's a hell of a lot of work that goes on before it actually goes to peer review with Intellect, isn't there?
Yeah.
And it's great just working with them as well.
And I think what sets us aside from all of this, from the majority of the academic publishing, is the peer review in the middle of all of this, that like a lot of products and a lot of DIY cultural output doesn't have a peer review in it. But that's what marks us as different, because we have a stringent academic peer review process, so that this material gets agreed that it's substantial and of academic and intellectual value too, and that is alongside of the design is certainly something that is vitally important in terms of maintaining a scholarship that is of a quality that is that hopefully will be like the CCCS in 30 odd years look back upon, that they dealt with some really good stuff, but at the heart of that was a rigorous academic process.
Thanks, George. That's a really good point. Mike runs his own little publisher. I shouldn't call it that, Mike. Mike runs his own publishing house called Itchy Monkey, and we produce DIY books, and I end up designing those for Mike as well. But those tend to be poetry books or collections of essays by punks reflecting on their life or reflecting on their notion of punk. But they're not academic books. They're of interest to academics, but they're not academic books. And so when Barry came along with the Yugoslavian book, we said, well, we could do this with Itchy Monkey. We could do this DIY book for the kind of the underground punk market, or we could take it to the academic publisher. It could fit either of those things. As it, I think it will get better distribution through through our Global Punk imprint. But it is that interesting thing that Gauds is right. I think there is an academic rigor and a peer review process, which we don't need to do for Itchy Monkey books, but we do need to do for these books. And we're trying to separate those two things out, saying this is good. There's quality to these things. They're not just a DIY punk book that we're bunging out there through through the academic marketplace. They have got value.
Well, the longitudinal, the crass reflection, my crass reflections books now, it's in its third edition. You know, it's steaming off the shelves again, and we're writing a book on nonsense for Itchy Monkey. You know, which kind of lampoons the kind of academic writing process, but also brings in lots of absurdist recycled art. Yeah. So it's about kind of, you know, punk's always been about sticking two fingers up with boundaries and rules. And that's what we're about in certain ways. But that's much more Itchy Monkey than the book series. Yeah. But we can't see these things so much as separate. It's what we do in beyond the book series as well. Mm. With the journal and PSN and blah, blah.
And it seems like you're also able to get things out with what you're doing much more in a... quickly, right? Like, or a faster pace than sometimes if you are just letting the publisher do all the work. Sometimes that take, right? You know, it's like, okay, we've got this together. It's going to come out in a year or 2 years. And it seems that you're able to find what you want to put together and be like, we're going to get this out and we're going to do this and we're not waiting 5 years for it.
Well, I think the benefit we have is we've got a great publisher, and I will, you know, put a thumbs up again for Intellect. I know them because I've been editing the Punk and Post-Punk Journal for 10 years now. They are risk takers. They're a small publisher in Bristol in the UK, but they've got distribution in the States through University of Chicago Press. And they started as in a back room of a bedsit doing a computer science journal. There wasn't one in the marketplace. So they launched a computer artificial intelligence journal 20-odd years ago. And that took off. And then they started from there saying, well, how do we invest in potential new disciplines or new areas of research which there isn't a journal for yet? Mm. And they're risk takers. We approached them in 2012. I did with some previous colleagues. And said, can we do a journal of punk and post-punk? And they suggested, and that was unheard of. There was no publisher would touch that at that time. And they said, well, yeah, let's try it. Let's try a journal of punk and post-punk. And they are really willing to say, well, you're the experts. You bring the content to us. And if you think you've peer-reviewed, you've gone through a process and you think this has got value, then we'll trust you and we will put our side into it. So we've got our DIY hats on, and they've got their business heads on. So we'll see. We'll try this, and we'll do this book. So we'll do this book series, and we hope we can sell some copies of it. But they're not in it. They're not looking at it from the point of view of a major capitalist. Is there an investment here? And they're also allowing us to come to them with our enthusiasm and our energy to say we want to do this and turn it around. Relatively quickly, the journal comes out three times a year, and I'm working about a year ahead at the moment on the journal because it's just full all the time with new content. And then from that, we get the connections to bring in content to the books as well, which has been fantastic. It's really rich.
And of course,
but I think the publisher, we've got to give praise to the publisher for being so flexible to allow us that a level of control, which I think is very unusual. I've not come across that with publishers before. I've published several books with several publishers, and it's largely been difficult, but this has been completely different.
And also what happens is because we've got that control of every single part of the process, it means that when we get stuff back from authors to change parts of the text, you know, corrections, it means that, you know, Russ just gets on and he does them. And if we need to get peer review, because we're in constant contact with each other, you know, the punk pedagogy came through peer review. Well, I know where that's going to go. That's going to go there. Russ is already sorting out Barry's book. I'm in conversation with Simon Strange about getting his book and getting that peer reviewed. And so we're working all the time, all hours really, to try to get this stuff done. And then when it comes around to actually designing it, Russ is just right. I'm going to get this designed. you know, sends it over to me. I have a look at it. You know, I'm kind of proofing it all the time as well. And so, it really, really fastens things up, doesn't it, Russ?
It does. I think that what publishers tend to work with, either they're in-house or external production managers and pre-proof art workers, etc. Mm. And there's always a delay on those things. They say, oh, the turnaround from the stage one proof to stage two proof, they would give a designer, say, a month to do that. And I normally do it in about a day because I'm on it and it's my baby, my project, it's our project, is what we're working on. So I'm happy to take that on. I can turn that around and get it back. I'm not in a queue with other design jobs from a design agency. I'm able to act quite quickly and independently. So I think there's some benefits from that.
So we've been talking for a while. Probably could talk to you forever. But I'm trying to think of the best way to ask this. Like, what do you want to, or what do you think? We've talked sort of about what you have coming out, what you have out, but like, do you see, what do you envision maybe for sort of punk and punk scholarship within the next few years? Right? Do you have maybe there isn't anything that you're like, we would love to see this happen, but I'm wondering if there's something you'd really love to see or love to see more of, as we think about punk as scholarship, right? Like punk scholarship in this sort of being in an academic space, right?
I think for me, I've got kind of, I'm very lucky in the sense that my institution, Middlesex University, really supports me in this. And they recognised the work that I put in it. We're in our eighth annual conference for the PSN. The ninth next year, this year isn't held in France. Next year, the key event is held in the Netherlands. And then for PSN 10, there is a plan for Russ and myself to hold it in London. And I think that's, for me, is to get to that PSN 10.
Right.
And also, if we talk about kind of little projects as well, I see the kind of the punk reader as my little baby, really. I'd like to see that continue. And especially with kind of putting up on whatever Ed Avery's doing, is really continuing to put upon different methodologies into punk. And I don't mean that in just looking at modern punk scenes. I think we've got to keep going back, and I think that kind of methodology needs to still go back and study the punk in the 1970s and punk onwards. So, and I think that's really what's good with the book series, is that, you know, yeah, with Barry Phillips' book, it goes back to the 1980s. You know, with Marie Scove's book, we're going back to the 1970s again, and Simon Stranger, but we're going back to the 1970s. It's inclusive. We include everyone in that. And that includes those old punks, older punks. Sorry, Russ. I'm only a mere lad. It's inclusive. We include everything.
I think that's the key thing, is that we could just try and keep track of contemporary punk scene. So Mike and Gore's original idea was, what's happening now? What's post 2000? What's happening now? How do we document that as a series of books? And that is an ongoing series of books. What's happening around the world? What's the story from Southern Europe? What's the story from Southeast Asia? What's the story from India and Pakistan or the Soviet Union? What can we do to build those contemporary observations of those scenes around the world? But there's also other ways of looking at the history. And I'm kind of, you know, I'm a designer, I'm a design writer and a design historian, and to a certain extent a punk historian. And I want to be able to go back to those 1970s stories and move away from the histories that have been written and say, well, what other ways are there of looking at that stuff? I want to see the economics of 1970s punk. I want to see, you know, how it was facilitated and supported by venues, by labels, by managers, by bar owners. What was the economics behind it? How do those things fit together? I'm really interested in the stories that haven't been told. of 70s punk, not just repeating the ones that have been told over and over again. Everybody knows the story of the Ramones or the Sex Pistols. Much as I love the Ramones and the Sex Pistols, I want to know, okay, there's other stories to be told even about them, other ways of interrogating what they did. And that those to me are still fascinating. I still want to be able to look back, because I'm one of the old punks rather than Mike describes.
There are also opportunities with Master Lydon touring England right now.
Yeah.
But there's a prime opportunity to do ethnography with that, to go to a few and to take notes and to listen to what he said, because the discussion of the Sex Pistols doesn't finish with their breakup. You know, it's the way that term is used, the band is used by the members, and the disagreements that happen and get recycled and reused up to now. I mean, I don't know where Lydon is tonight doing his routine, but he's going to be somewhere. And that means we're going back nearly 50 years now to the start of all of that. And that's so, so important. I mean, for me, my kind of date with punk scholarship is sadly coming to an end. I'm not hugely interested now. I was one of the first in punk scholarship back in 95, you know, and then me and Russ were, and I think Mike were at the punk conference in 2001 at Wolverhampton, which was interesting. But what we've got now are like intellectual developments alongside the work of Mark Fisher and Hauntology in the way that the past is used in the present and the kind of return to imaginary pasts and all that kind of stuff. That's where I am, and that's what I want to see with the punk scholarship. And I'm much more interested in doing a lot more art and publishing my PhD, which seems to be waiting 15 years to come out. But I want to go into new directions now, because I don't do music live anymore. And I'm not so much involved in the scene. And that's what I would like to do anyway with it, you know.
Could I just quickly say as well, I know we're right at the end, that the Punk Scholars Network and the Global Punk Series and what we do would also not be possible. We've got Paola, we've got Russ, we've got Gords, but there's also Laura Way, who organised the first Punk Scholars conference with myself, who's going to be talking over in the Netherlands in December for the PSN 8. There's Francis Stewart, that does some really good stuff on straight edge and religion. Matt Grimes has put a hell of a lot of work in to this, as well as General Secretary of the PSN. And Pete Dale has been organising each conference as well. And I just want to get their names out there as well, because...
Right, so really creating this sort of DIY network, right? And making it happen, which is what you need to, when you're trying to do kind of multi or an interdisciplinary work. It's how it has to, if you want that to happen, you've got to sort of find the people and find and create that yourself, right? So like I said, I could probably talk forever, but it's been really wonderful. So this was Russ Besley, Mike Dines, Gords, and Paul Aguera, who have compiled the Punk Reader and the Punk Reader series that it can be found at Intellect Books. And so you call the latest one, which is, what's the one coming right out?
One coming up is Punk Identities, Punk Utopias, Global Punk and Media, and another one called Punk Las Americas, which is largely South American edition. They're both due out around about November.
And if you want right now, you can get the Punk Reader and the Trans Global Punk Scenes, which is volume 2 of the Punk Reader. Again, thank you all for talking with me for New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture.
Right. Thank you. Thanks.